Good afternoon. This is Chris Moore with Festival Showcase on Aspen Public Radio, the official voice of the Aspen Music Festival and School. Funding for Festival Showcase is provided by the Barnard Fane Foundation. Each week, we interview the musicians, composers, conductors, students, and teachers who make the music at Aspen Music Festival. Today, we talk with Aspen Music Festival and School President and CEO Alan Fletcher, as well as Vice President for Artistic Administration and Artistic Advisor Asadora Santurian about the 68th season and why it's called the Season of Enchantment.
I wanted to explore aspects of music that are transformative. Simply, the most ready example would be theme and variations. A simple theme that is evolved through the composer's imagination to other places, and taking that transformation idea to other places. And of course, in the planning, I always have the best possible brains with Robert and Alan. And so we have created a season of transformative works, and enchantment being the sometimes the means, and sometimes the result, and sometimes the starting point, and it evolves to even a greater place, like Clemenza, which ends with clemency for all.
It's funny, because when I first think of enchantment, I think of something like Rimsky-Korsakov's Scheherazade, which I believe is on the program this season. Just magical tales, I guess you might say. But it seems like what you're talking about could include things like Strauss's Death and Transfiguration, or things that have more of an inward quality of transformation as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think when I remember those first discussions, we had the Ravel opera, L'Enfant et le Sortilège, right away. Damnation of Faust, with which we end the season, is actually a particularly enchanted telling of the story and the roles of Marguerite and Mephistopheles and Faust. They're talking about transformation, transfiguration, enchantment all the time.
From a practical point of view, maybe just to help people organize their minds around this schedule of something like 300 concerts, maybe, Alan, you could just go through what do people hear weekly on Thursdays, on Fridays, etc., and just kind of go through the week with the different orchestras or the different chamber concerts.
Sure. If I do the comprehensive version, Monday is usually our quietest day, but it's one of our most important chamber music series. So that is Monday at 6 p.m. in Harris Hall. Tuesdays, we have master classes in the morning and then our conducting academy orchestra, 4 to 6 in the afternoon in the tent. It's become one of our most popular offerings, really. It's a tremendous series. And then Tuesday evenings, recitals. Wednesdays, we have our High Notes talks that are also broadcast here on Aspen Public Radio, and that's at noon. We have our Aspen Philharmonic Orchestra at 6 p.m., and then typically a recital in Harris Hall following that. Thursdays, it's another big masterclass day, including our Harris Hall series and also typically recitals in the evening. Friday is our Chamber Symphony at 6 p.m., occasionally, we have something following it in Harris Hall, not every week. Saturday morning, opera scenes, another super popular thing at the Wheeler Opera House. Another one of our chamber music series, Saturday afternoons at 4:30 in Harris Hall. And then typically a big marquee recital or a special event. Our tribute to Ella Fitzgerald, done with Jazz Aspen Snow Mess on July 1st, is a good example of that. Sunday morning, the dress rehearsal of the Festival Orchestra. I do want to already give mention to the audience that on the day Renee Fleming sings, July 30, she will not be doing a dress rehearsal in the morning. And then Sunday at 4, our Aspen Festival Orchestra. So that's the week.
Which could be 180 musicians sometimes.
especially this year because of the Berlioz. Operas come and go. We have two major productions in the Wheeler this summer, Traviata that opens and then Clemenza di Tito in our final week. And those will each have three performances.
That's right. And in the middle will be Luke Bedford's Seven Angels in Harris in concert format.
Right. How do you manage to find rehearsal time for all these various chamber groups, orchestras, everything else? It must be a challenge.
Well, I will say for the audience, they might be interested that we have a very complex software called Arts Vision. This was actually initially developed for us and the Metropolitan Opera, being two organizations that have the most intense rehearsal schedules. And we need to know where every person among our 600-some students and 120-some faculty and more than 100 guest artists, we need to know where they are at all times. We need to know, and the software will tell us this, if the Hari Janosch suite requires three bassoons and contra or not, so mm-hmm. that we can be planning who is at what rehearsal, what equipment is where. The percussion equipment alone is a jigsaw puzzle that's very hard to manage. But sometimes people say, oh, I see you don't have a recital in Harris that day. Could we just... I have to say no. Harris is being used for rehearsal for all of these chamber music activities. Very often in our chamber music series, a concert will have seven different chamber music ensembles performing. They all have to be rehearsed. They have to be together for the rehearsal, etc. So
mm-hmm. That's it's a puzzle. Huge challenge. Yeah, I can imagine.
It's a labyrinthine puzzle. The software enables us to identify these many aspects, including personnel conflicts, as well as how many performances a person is involved in, and then give us also an individual person's itinerary for the summer.
Well, Asador, one thing I'm very curious with you, I mean, of course, there's some famous artists, I mean, Sarah Chang or Gil Shaham, a lot of people who've been here before and who are coming back, and it's great. But as somebody who comes here year after year, I'm always very excited about looking at artists who I don't know. How do you find them? Do you fly to Europe? Do you fly all over the U.S.? I mean, how do you decide?
I think it's a combination of things. Alan also hears people on his travels, and Robert does as well, and people communicate with us through email, so we do check them out. So I think we like to present people that we have heard live, so we know the capacity of the person's artistry. But also, I don't want to negate the fact that our wonderful core of artists who return are returning in different guises. We are blessed to have relationships with Gil Shaham, Sarah Chang, and Renee Fleming, and Bobby McDuffie, and Yefim Bronfman. But we also work with them to give us something new, something that is another aspect of their musical personality. So there's also something new in the returning artists. The artists who we present in a debut, they have to have a compelling reason. And oftentimes, because we have such riches of our own alumni, we try to introduce artists who are leaders in the same field, perhaps the violin, piano, cello, voice, but were trained by teachers other than our faculty. And they get the same special atmosphere, and yet they arrive at it from another perspective, a teaching perspective. And that's important for us to also recognize and put side by side with the great teaching that takes place here in Aspen.
We do like to make an investment in a player. So although there will be some people who come and give a recital or play a concerto and are never seen again in the mountains, more often Asador and his team have chosen so carefully that I can remember Nikolai Luganski's first time.
Yes.
And he's now a seasoned artist with us. Simone Porter, who of course was a student with us. But when we made the decision to present her as a guest artist, it was not made lightly. It was made with the idea that this will be one of the Sarah Chang or Gil Shahams of the future. Another good point to make is that we have a unique relationship with the Van Cliburn Foundation in Fort Worth, and we do commit to present their winners, either gold or silver medalist, every 4 years. And that's just concluded, and we're going to have the young man who won the gold medal in recital on August 15th.
That's worth mentioning. I think this is the first year that they've ever had it live streamed, like a Met Opera. So my wife actually went out there and spent 5.5 hours watching piano concertos. I couldn't believe she did that, and I was impressed. But there will be people who are listening here who are familiar with that artist simply because of that.
Right.
Which is unusual, I think, because most people, who's the Van Cliburn winner? You get a name, and that's all you get until you hear them. I wanted to ask also, you have, of course, the big main stage operas, but then you have a couple operas that are, well, either lesser known or not fully staged. I think Seven Angels is one of them. And that deals with the subject of climate change. When you take on a subject that's delicate like this, do you need to think in terms of possibly losing sponsorships or losing audiences or alienated parts of the audience? Are these concerns that have to go in besides just the artistic concern of putting on a piece of work that you think is good artistically?
Well, let me answer, and then we'll see what Asador thinks about this. I am not aware that we have ever programmed something for a political reason. On the other hand, so much important art is inherently political. and works of Verdi were intensely political in their time. We no longer really experience them that way unless they're staged that way. Works of Mozart were political. Works of Beethoven were very political. In terms of Luke Bedford's opera, we did make the choice on its musical and dramatic, operatic merits, and the fact that it has that layer of political meaning is also inherent in the work.
I'll pick up a thread from Alan's excellent outline in that Clemenza di Tito, for example, it depicts two intriguers,
yes,
who are plotting regicide. This at a time when monarchs were sponsoring Mozart's opera. Mm-hmm. So it did raise a few eyebrows, and he did face a few censors who were discussing. But the idea of stopping Mozart's opera, where the king shows incredible humanity by forgiving, which is what won the case for Mozart, and Traviata, where aristocrats are depicted fraternizing with the demi-monde. Yes, it happened, but not necessarily it's something that they wanted known and publicized, particularly mm-hmm. in an opera that they're attending with their wives. So, you know, the times are the times. And this work was really inspired by Dante's Inferno, a specific episode that Glyn Maxwell, the author and poet, decided to highlight and perhaps give it a more contemporaneous interpretation, but it is in no way a political position. It is the way that the seven angels find the earth. And the work itself, interestingly, has two grand rite payments. One is to the author, the librettist, and one is to the composer. It's usually not the case that the librettist also gets a grand rites fee.
Mm-hmm.
So the work is published separately as well, I guess to make a point, but we are presenting it as a musical work in concert format.
Mm-hmm. So on the politics, I'm not at present at all concerned that anyone who supports us is going to step away for any of these reasons. We did just learn that we have again received the largest national endowment grant given in the state of Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not shy to say that we believe strongly the endowment should be continued, although it is the largest grant given in the state, and I don't want to sound that as if I minimize it. It is less than a fifth of a percent of our budget, so it's not the money so much as the statement that the U.S. makes in making grants to arts creating organizations in every county in the United States, and I think that is so significant and is of great importance.
There's a number of concerti that I have not heard. It looks to me as though there are several either world premieres or at least American premieres or Aspen premieres of concerti by living composers. Is that something that you decided to give a little extra focus to this year in general?
I think we began to, as it turned out, that a couple of serendipitous things happened. Every year we choose a composer among our students to invite back with a large orchestral work. And last summer, the young man that we chose, Matthew Ricketts, said, "May I write a piano concerto?" And so we said yes. That automatically meant we're going to have one more than we thought we were going to have. Gil Shaham, as Osador says, he does very different things in all of his visits. He has an extraordinarily broad repertoire and broad interests, and he asked if he could do Jonathan Leshnoff's concerto. So about the time we said yes to that, and then Jennifer Koh wanted to do Anna Klein's, and we began seeing, oh, we're going to have a lot of new works, even Robert Levin saying he would like to do a recreation. Recreation is not really the word.
Reconstruction
of a late work of Mozart's.
And your work was in the pipeline.
But that's been a couple of
years.
That work. It was in the pipeline to be done, and it's going to have two premieres this summer. So
it wasn't something you were actively searching for, but it's turned out that that's become a big part of the season.
We're constantly,
regularly, and often looking for interesting works to present.
Mm-hmm.
And when, in this case, they turn out to be concertos, that's fine.
Well, Alan, speaking of concertos, and for those of you who may not know, on July 30th, it's going to be a premiere of, I believe, your only piano concerto so far.
Yes.
other composers I've talked to, when they write either an opera or a piano concerto, they swear they're never going to do it again because it's so many notes. What was it like for you? Because it's probably in some ways even bigger than writing a symphony in terms of the sheer amount of time that it takes to put the notes down on paper.
Especially writing for Enon Barnaton. Enon has already, in his very young life, really great string of concertos that he's premiered and championed. And so the opportunity to write for him imposes or offers, whichever you like, an obligation on the composer. It had better be good. It had better be worth his time because he's going to spend a lot of time. I'm not so worried about all the notes, but Enon has to be worried about all the notes because he's got a lot of them to play. And also the fact that we had settled that it would be on a Sunday and thus a very large orchestra. It could easily have gone differently. At the same time, I was writing a concerto for Daniel Hope and the Zurich Chamber Orchestra, New Century Chamber Orchestra. And that one, by contrast, Daniel had said, there will only be 10 violins, you know, 5 violas, 4 cellos, etc. It'll be a very small ensemble. But for Enon, we knew it was going to be big. So yeah, one starts out thinking a concerto this size and for an artist of this importance needs to be making a statement.
I don't think of you as a composer who does a lot of flashy, virtuosic stuff. Your music has more of a kind of a lyrical quality, kind of a inward-looking quality. I'm wondering how much the element of virtuosity is there, because you do have a big orchestra, a big audience, and a pianist who could do just about anything.
Yep.
When you were thinking about how to put this together, were there places in it where you felt it was appropriate to integrate actual virtuosity into it rather than just maybe lyricism or other elements?
Yeah, it's a very big piece. It's very, very difficult. I was meeting Enon in Miami, Florida at an event where he played for us, and he was touring with Academy of St. Martin in the Fields. After the concert with the Academy, we sat down for a late dinner, and I presented him with his score for the first time. The first thing he did was turned to the last page, and he said, "Thank you." I said, "Thank me." And he said, "Thank you for writing a really big ending."
So you had to do some of that.
Yep. He's a bit like a soprano looking for the high notes.
Well, but, you know, it's one of very many questions for any concerto composer, but especially the piano concerto, because the pianist is doing something very unlike anyone else in the orchestra.
Right.
And so there's an obvious opposition between them, but is it going to end big or not? There are extremely important concertos that end quietly. Is it going to start with a big orchestra flourish or not? And there are great concertos that do that, and there are great ones that don't. Is it going to start with the piano alone or not, similarly?
Right.
There are many important examples where concertos do. And so those were all big questions.
I have another question around that, too, and perhaps another big question, I guess, and that's that traditionally, if you go way back to the Baroque concertos, concerere, to play together, it's just a group of people playing together with a soloist, and then it became more like the contest between the soloist and the orchestra, the soloist becoming the individual versus society or whatever. What relationship do you see on an expressive level between the pianist and the orchestra in this piece?
In this case, it's a give and take. They are doing something together. There are important passages, though, where the pianist is challenging the orchestra, or vice versa, in, I think, a pretty obvious dramatic way. I did want the piece to have a dramatic arc to it. It's not just a whole bunch of stuff that happens and then it stops happening. And yet then, for instance, in the last movement, members of the orchestra, soloists from within the orchestra, step up, as it were. I don't think we'll actually have them step up.
Thank you.
But anyway, they suddenly are playing a leading soloistic role, and the pianist begins to accompany them until a certain point where it's only decent to let the pianist take over.
Chris, I have a question for Alan. For 7-8 years, you've been hearing Enon play with orchestra and his very many interesting programs that he's curated for us in recital. How much of that was helpful to you in tailoring the concerto to him or for his abilities?
Yeah, thank you. I do have a pretty detailed awareness of his, not his technical abilities. As you said, Chris, he can do anything. There would be nothing that I could have put in there that he would have said no. On the other hand, I've heard some things that I think he particularly likes. A funny point, I don't think Ina knows this, is that during the composition of the piece, I believed I was going to introduce a really extensive quote from Mendelssohn, straight out quote, of a piece that I heard Enon play years ago. It's one of my favorite pieces. It's a sort of encore piece, Rondo Capriccioso. And when I came to the moment it was going to inhabit, I thought, it's just too weird to have him start playing this. So in the end, I didn't do it. But I did introduce a very brilliant technical idea that is taken from the Mendelssohn. I imagine when Enon sits down and is really learning it, he'll go, hey, this is just what happens in that Mendelssohn.
Right. If you've just joined us, this is Festival Showcase on Aspen Public Radio, the official voice of the Aspen Music Festival and school. We've been chatting with Alan Fletcher and Asador Centurion about the upcoming season of the Aspen Music Festival and school. The season opener features violinist Arnold Sussman, cellist David Finkel, and pianist Wu Han. Here's a conversation with David Finkel and Wu Han.
It's always wonderful to come back. And that convocation is such a wonderful, inspiring gathering. And the speeches are fantastic. And you know you have so much to look forward to, having the experience, the Aspen experience, and enjoying the festival. I love going to the convocation.
Yes.
I love sitting on the stage, listening to the brass behind me. And
yeah, 50 old, brass players.
Exactly. Yes. And then seeing all the old friends coming back and the students and such energy and such inspiring place, especially these days in our world, we all need that.
And I'd like to ask you, David, tell us about all three of you as musicians and the pieces that you're going to be playing that open up the Harris Hall concert on Thursday.
Well, we're very, very excited to be bringing this young French violinist, Arnaud Sussman, with us this time. He was a discovery of ours through our Chamber Music Society 2 program at the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center in New York, way back in some of the earliest auditions that we did. This is at least 10 years ago. And Arnaud, although he professed not to know any chamber music, turned out to be one of the most fantastic chamber music players that we've ever encountered. He is also just a beautiful violinist and now a consummate musician. For us to, of course, to return to Aspen and especially to open the festival is a great honor and a thrill. But to be able to bring who will be a discovery for the festival here is a double thrill, and we could not be more excited.
You, Wuhan, I think are playing on all three of the pieces that are on the program, and you're the only one of the trio that does that does all three of them. So tell me a little bit about the three pieces and also the way in which you interact as a chamber player, that every time you walk on the stage, you're conversing with someone else.
Absolutely. We will start a program with the Brahms E minor sonata, which is a most glorious opening for the program, also for the festival as well. The Brahms E minor sonata is really the staple of cello piano duo. To play with David, it's always an honor and pleasure, even after we're married for 33 years now. Oh my goodness. Then we will go from Brahms to Dvorak. Dvorak is good friends with Brahms. Actually, Brahms was the one introduced Dvorak to his publisher, Simrock, to ask Simrock to publish Dvorak's work.
Some would say that's one of the few nice things he ever did.
Oh,
because
apparently
he was not a very nice man in many ways.
But. Well, he could be very terse, but I think in deep inside, or actually in private, he has helped a lot of musicians. And in this case, it's really symbolic as well. We are introducing a young, wonderful musician to the festival. So this particular gesture is important for a senior musician like both of us. And I think it's important for everyone to keep invested into the next generation of musicians' future. Arnaud will play Dvorak's Sonatine. This Sonatine was written in the United States and is filled with charm and delightful melody. Arnold played this piece like nobody else. I heard this piece played many, many times, and he was my favorite choice of the violinist.
See,
to work
this
with.
This is a truly fantastic international artistic collaboration, because you have a French violinist, a Chinese pianist playing a piece by a Czech composer that was inspired by American music. So you could not get more international or global than this performance. And I think also that you will hear, after the Brahms, when you hear this Dvorak, you will hear exactly why Brahms admired Dvorak so much because his gift for melody, for harmony, was unsurpassed. He was almost like a Schubert. And Brahms actually expressed a little jealousy once in a while of how easily and naturally things came to Dvorak. And you'll hear it in the first half of this concert.
The second half, then we decided to take the Mendelssohn C minor trio, so three of us can finish a whole big program. This particular trio is also symbolic. Mendelssohn's family are quite close to the monarchies, and his father was an important banker. And in order to survive or serve his father's purpose, the family convert into Christianity. So in this particular piece, you will hear two sort of important feeling coincide with each other. The last movement has this very sort of Jewish oy vey kind of opening. And then in the middle, there's incredible, beautiful chorale will show up, and he will mix two of them together. It's very symbolic these days for us to play a piece like that, to know that things can coexist. And the piece itself is just so exciting and so beautiful. It's really one of his masterpieces. The D minor trio is more often played and more often found on the on the concert stage. It's delightful, it's joyous. This particular one, for me, the C minor trio is so much deeper and so much more virtuosic. And I enjoy playing it so, so much. So it's a perfect ending and the perfect start to start the music festival.
Let me ask, I have to ask, of course, about your students, because you put on a very exciting student chamber recital every year, and I know you're doing that again this year. Can you tell us a little bit about the musicians or about the repertoire that you have this year and how you are going to either inspire or enslave them or whatever your techniques are to get them up to shape to play at such a high level by the end of that training that you
Well, we know that individually each one of them is very well qualified. I think we have a couple of returns from previous season, but for the most part, they're all new to us. We have yet to hear them all play and meet most of them in person for the first time, which will happen very soon. Stay tuned. After that, we could give you a much better assessment of where they are with the piece, how fully they've grasped it, how many rehearsals they have. They've been working in anticipation of our arrival here. So it's going to be a very exciting moment to get together, to meet with them, to hear them play, to sort of map their course for them for these days that we're working together. And then we'll go have a big party. And get to know them personally and their backgrounds and their families. And we look forward to doing both.
This concert will be at 7:30 and July 10th. And there will be three great chamber music chestnuts. It will be Schumann Piano Quartet, Smetana Trio, and Beethoven Opus 70 number 2. It will happen. It is one concert and it's free for the public. It's something I know in the next 2 weeks, two of us will be with them almost daily and really sharpen up all the detail, which is what made this program special. We're not just seeing them an hour a week. It's a very intense schedule for them, a very intense studying for them. In the end, I hope we can bring them from now till July 10th. We want to see them just jump and excel and really put the best foot forward and take the best chances.
Now, in past years, I've been able to bring some of the students in for an interview. Do you think there's a chance we can find time to do that again this year?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh,
they will love that so much. You know how excited they were. Part of the training is also actually teach them how to communicate verbally. I remember preparing for your interview. A lot of them are actually quite nervous. What should I say? I say, look, guys, think of something that's really meaningful for you. Something is meaningful for the listener, and you should really know a little bit about the background of the piece that you're playing so you can always talk about it. It's part of the education. We'll see how they do this time.
Okay. Cellist David Finkel and pianist Wu Han talking up their season-opening concert this Thursday evening at Harris Hall. Funding for Festival Showcase is provided by the Barnard Fane Foundation. You've been listening to Festival Showcase on Aspen Public Radio, the official voice of the Aspen Music Festival and School, in a feature we're proud to present here throughout the summer. I'm Chris Moore. Join me every week for another Festival Showcase, Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m.